From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. On August 9th, the Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 387 points on worries about defaults on so-called subprime mortgage loans. The panic was palpable.
Good evening. In plain English, the wings fell off Wall Street earlier today, and as the Dow Jones plunged
387 points, problems in the subprime mortgage market
today after Asian and European
global
markets fell overnight. This after yesterday's
crisis sent the Dow down 387 points.
Financial stories have a hard time reaching the headlines, but sometimes it's easy. Dow up, good. Dow down, bad. Sure enough, a few days later, when central banks intervened and the U.S. Fed cut interest rates, stocks rebounded, the media expressed relief, and went on to browner pastures. But in failing to see the crisis coming and in quickly losing interest, was the media coverage of the subprime fiasco subprime? Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, thinks so. The breathless reporting on market gyrations, he says, overshadowed the underlying problems.
Well, basic story of a subprime mortgage are that these are people getting mortgages who don't have good credit ratings. And what's going on is there's been a real explosion in the issuance of subprime mortgages over the last 5 or 6 years. There have been subprime for some time, but they were generally a very small segment, 2, 3, 4% of the market. That just exploded so that subprime mortgages account for 25% of all mortgages in 2006.
But it was no secret before 2 weeks ago when the Dow Jones went on the skids. Where was the reporting about the danger of subprime mortgages till now?
Well, it was largely lacking. I mean, there were a few good stories here and there, and I'll single out the New York Times for having done some pieces about the subprime market and the risks it posed. But for the most part, the media was ignoring this, and it was a mass phenomenon. I mean, this was, as I say, hundreds of thousands, millions of subprime mortgages being issued. Clearly, there's hundreds of billions of dollars of that debt out there, and that's now going bad at a very rapid rate.
You would have thought the dot-com bubble of the late 90s would have taught the financial press some lessons. How could they have failed to see the real estate bubble and the effects of bad loans?
In effect, they bought the story that this is different. They bought the optimism of the real estate industry that this was a good thing, that house prices were going through the roof, that many low-income people that previously couldn't get homes were now buying them. This was all treated as a positive without noting any of the risks associated. We actually did an exit search in 2005-2006. The major source in news reporting on housing was David Lira, who's the chief economist with the National Association of Realtors, and he actually wrote a book about why the housing boom will not bust and how you could profit from it. Now, you know, I don't object to anyone talking to David Lira. He's a very knowledgeable person about housing. But the idea that he would be your sole source, which he was in many, many cases, that's just irresponsible reporting.
All right, now let's come back to the current situation. The markets seem to have stabilized after the central banks intervened and the U.S. Fed cut the discount rates. What effect did that have? And more importantly, did it really solve any of the structural problems?
Well, what it does is it affects buys time. But the underlying problem is that you have, as I say, hundreds of billions. It could be over a trillion. You have an awful lot of bad debt in the form of mortgage-backed securities that is still being held. And my concern on all this is that if the point of buying time is to allow the people who are holding that bad debt to sell it off to others who might be less well-informed, that's not in any obvious way a good thing.
Do you have the sense that the fact that the NASDAQ and the Dow Jones average and the other major markets of the world recovered so much after the intervention of central banks, that the media has sort of taken their eye off the ball and they say, well, this problem's solved. Let's just move on to hurricanes and the political campaigns.
They tend to focus on mayhem in the markets, and that's sort of an easy story to tell that the markets went up 2% a given day. That's sort of an easy, simple story to tell, and you want the stock market to go up. That's kind of the theme of the story, and it's bad news when it goes down. The underlying story, and that's really what they should be focused on, is what's causing these gyrations in the market. And yeah, I very much worry that with the market, for the moment at least, being somewhat more settled today, that the underlying problem is going to be ignored.
Can we assume on any given day that the market goes up, that is unalloyed good, and the market goes down, that is bad? Is that assumption right to begin with?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, the market could be going up for a number of reasons. And one, let's say, is the good one. The economy's growing, and part of that story is that profits will be higher in the future. The market sees that, and stocks are going up. That, I think we could pretty much say, is a good story. On the other hand, profits might be going up for reasons that we may not think are good. Maybe workers are getting paid less. So if you own a lot of stock, of course, you're happy with that story. But if you're like most people and get most of your income from your wages, that's not particularly good news. So you probably shouldn't be cheering the Dow Jones in that case. And the third case is simply an irrational movement. And we saw that. That was the story of the bubble in the late 90s. So again, that was not, you know, particularly good unless, you know, the only people that was really good for were people who were speculating and smart enough to get out before the crash. But for the rest of us, it's very hard to see how that was a good thing.
Dean, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Dean Baker is co-founder and director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. This week in Baghdad commenced another Crimes Against Humanity trial for 15 flunkies of Saddam Hussein, accused in the massacre of tens of thousands of Shia in southern Iraq following an uprising against Saddam in the wake of the first Gulf War. But if the brutality of the reprisal was chilling, so was what immediately preceded it.
There's another way for the bloodshed to stop, and that is for the Iraqi military and the Iraqi people to take matters into their own hands, to force Saddam Hussein, the dictator, to step aside.
Was President George H.W. Bush's 1991 suggestion a signal to Shiites that the U.S. military in Iraq would back them up? If so, it was a false signal. The U.S. did not intervene when Saddam's forces perpetrated their bloodbath. Christopher Hansen, assistant professor of journalism at the University of Maryland, was reporting from southern Iraq at the time. He says that amid the euphoria of the military triumph, the story of the rebellion was undercovered at the time, leaving the question of culpability a murky one then and now.
It would be simplistic to say that it sparked it, but the fact that he encouraged it at all raised all the questions about should the United States Army intervene to try to stop the killing. So there was enough of a linkage, I think, between the Bush administration's encouragement of this revolt and the slaughter that ensued to add U.S. responsibility to the story, which, you know, as it's told today in coverage of this trial, doesn't really seem to get through.
Tell me about the contemporaneous reporting. Was the story sufficiently covered back then?
Well, probably not. The story was underreported in several ways for several reasons. For one thing, as this rebellion was starting to flare up, many of the reporters were going home. There was great budgetary pressure to bring them back. So the story, as defined by the narrative that everyone had been telling, was, we won. And so a lot of people accepted that and just went on about the rest of their lives. The reporters who stayed behind faced a number of obstacles. First of all, they had to get through the U.S. military. They didn't want them to go out there and cover a story about them not intervening to save people. Then once they got into the area where the rebellion was going on, they were defined by the Iraqis as the enemy. They couldn't exactly go up to an Iraqi general and say, what are you doing? They would be captured, possibly shot. So the gist of the story did get out, but then, because it wasn't fitting in with this narrative of victory, didn't really resonate with the media as a whole in the U.S., despite the real bravery of the reporters who went out there and tried to cover it.
Now, a moment ago, you made a very harsh allegation that the uprising was undercovered, at least in part, because it didn't really correspond with the overall storyline of triumph in Iraq. Now, it's hard for me to imagine editors at major news organizations telling their sub-editors or the reporters, no, this is a victory story.
No, it never happens that way, of course. The story did get through. It's not a deliberate conspiracy or anything like that. It's just kind of the way the press works. You get a story stuck in your mind, and it's hard to break out of it. And then the pieces that don't fit the story get underemphasized. And in this case, the historical memory in the public mind got fixed with the earlier simplistic story, and what happened in southern Iraq was eventually forgotten.
Now, at the time, you were with an army unit in southern Iraq.
Yeah, the 2nd Armored Cavalry Regiment.
did you feel pressure, subtle or otherwise, to bring back positive skewed stories or ones that, you know, fit in the overall victory narrative?
No. Basically, what I was there to do was to cover what this unit was doing and then describe what was happening as dispassionately as I could. And what the unit was doing was blowing hell out of the Iraqi army. But it was essentially, because of where I was and what I was seeing, a story of American victory. The uprising wasn't even getting really through to us, except, you know, we would listen to BBC and there'd be a little something about it. But I was pretty much in a news vacuum, and eventually I got back out of the unit and was preoccupied with writing about what I'd just seen, and then I had to go home.
So it's 16 years later, and 15 members of Saddam's former regime are on trial for their alleged crimes in southern Iraq, including the already condemned to die Chemical Ali. As you read the coverage now, is there enough context being reported as to exactly how these crimes came about to begin with?
I'd say not enough. I've been reading sort of daily dispatches out of it, and the articles I read really didn't have the context. It was basically, here are these bad guys. They've already been condemned for crimes against the Kurds, and now they're on trial for crimes against the people in the South. I mean, you don't really get a sense of why this happened, how it happened, whether the United States was partly responsible for it or anything else. I'm sure that if, you know, as this thing goes on, you will eventually see some stories that provide the context. But, you know, once again, does it get through to the overall public rather than the elite who read about foreign policy? I really doubt it.
Okay, Chris. Well, as always, thank you very much.
Well, glad to do it.
Christopher Hansen is an assistant professor at the Philip Merrill College of Journalism at the University of Maryland. Coming up, the making of the phrase sanctuary city. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Let them construct a sanctuary for me that I may dwell among them. Those words, spoken by the Lord in the book of Exodus, are almost certainly familiar to Mitt Romney and Rudolph Giuliani. When Moses received that command some 3,500 years ago, his understanding of the word sanctuary was as a place of refuge and safety. Oh, how times have changed.
New York is a sanctuary city. It is the most notorious sanctuary city.
We have a choice in this country. Are we a sanctuary nation or a sovereign nation?
This all stems from a sanctuary city policy that allows illegal immigrants to do anything they want to do.
It seems that sanctuary, in the parlance of Republican primary politics, has become a bad word. ABC News senior political correspondent Jake Tapper has been following the recent rhetoric, and he joins me now. Jake, welcome back to On the Media.
Always a pleasure.
Let's first define the term sanctuary city.
Well, conservatives are using this term disparagingly to criticize cities like New York City, Newark, some states even like Oregon and Alaska, where law enforcement does not pursue illegal immigrants for violating immigration laws, and city and state services are available to illegal immigrants and their children.
Now, the term sanctuary city had swirled around conservative talk radio and the right-wing blogosphere for a while, but it was only very recently that it showed up in the presidential campaign. You were actually at the event where Mitt Romney first broke this out.
Romney had been saying it a few times here and there on the stump, especially in Iowa, where this is a big issue among conservative Republican voters. He's trying to use it as a substantive way to paint Giuliani as a Manhattan liberal. He recently ran a radio ad talking about New York City being a sanctuary city.
Let's actually hear that radio spot.
Immigration laws don't work if they're ignored. That's the problem with cities like Newark, San Francisco, and New York City that adopt sanctuary policies. Sanctuary cities become magnets that encourage illegal immigration and undermine security.
We should point out that while Mitt Romney was governor of Massachusetts, three cities either reaffirmed or affirmed their status as sanctuary cities in Massachusetts. So while Romney's going after Giuliani as a liberal, Giuliani's campaign is going after Romney as a flip-flopper, and that fits into both narrative attacks against the other.
Now, You know, you could laugh this off up to a point, I suppose, but sometimes the rhetoric gets very heated and maybe very irresponsible. Tell me about how the shooting in Newark, New Jersey, earlier this month by Hispanic perpetrators has played into this whole debate about sanctuary.
Well, Newark is a city that is hospitable to illegal immigrants. And of the six individuals who have been arrested for shooting the college students earlier this month, two of them are in this country illegally, one from Peru and one from Honduras. And one of them, Jose Carranza, actually had been arrested earlier this year twice for two different violent crimes. So in Newark this weekend, you had a Republican presidential candidate, Tom Tancredo from Colorado, come into the city and say that if it weren't for Newark's policy as a sanctuary city, the crimes would not have happened. That's something that has now apparently changed. In Newark, police are now going to ask for the immigration status of individuals when they arrest them.
Is Jose Carranza going to be the Willie Horton of 2007?
That's an excellent question. I don't know. I would not be surprised.
Well, Jake, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Jake Tapper is a senior political correspondent for ABC News. Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California at Berkeley. He remembers a time when sanctuary wasn't an epithet.
Well, the word comes from a Latin word that means a sacred place. And in the Middle Ages, certain criminals and debtors were immune from arrest or persecution if they went into churches. And that's where the sense of sanctuary as a refuge comes in. I think most people, if they think of that sense of the word, at least film buffs or people of a certain generation, recall the 1939 Hunchback of Notre Dame, where Charles Laughton is Quasimodo, Marino Harris Esmeralda is about to be hanged outside the cathedral. Laughton swings down on a rope, plucks her from the executioner. That's the sense the word still had in the early 1980s when church groups originally led this movement to provide what they called sanctuary for refugees from the death squads in Guatemala and El Salvador, and then a number of cities declared themselves sanctuary cities in which those refugees would not be reported to the INS.
But then at some point, the word was expropriated, mainly by the political right, and suddenly sanctuary, you know, had an altogether different cast to it. How did that happen?
Well, sometime around 2005, 2006, you begin to hear people on the right using the word, not for these cities and movements that aimed at providing specifically political asylum, but rather to cities that said, look, we just don't think it's our business to have our local officials helping the INS. We don't want to discourage witnesses from coming forth in criminal cases. We don't want to discourage parents from bringing their children to emergency rooms. We don't want to discourage children from coming to school. So using sanctuary to describe these cities, it'd be sort of like saying that the military, because of its don't ask, don't tell policy, has become a sanctuary for homosexuals because you're not supposed to be there, but we're not going to ask whether that's what you're doing or not.
Mitt Romney has seized on this word sanctuary. Do you think sanctuary is the word that he's actually trying to communicate, or is he trying to use it as a kind of a code for something even more offensive to conservatives?
Well, I think sanctuary is very closely related to amnesty. It evokes that word illegal, which is used as a noun only to describe people's immigration status. You don't say that Jack Abramoff was an illegal because he lobbied illegally, for example. And in fact, the word illegal has always been used in just that way. It was first introduced in the English language by the British in the 1930s and early 40s to describe Jews who illegally emigrated to Palestine.
You know, so if you kind of do the arithmetic in your mind's eye with the vocabulary, you've gone from good thing, sanctuary, to kind of bad thing, sanctuary, to even worse thing, amnesty, to lawlessness and chaos and illegal aliens, I don't know, attacking our children.
Exactly. And one of the interesting things about the Romney ad is that he mentions cities in blue states, New York, Newark, San Francisco, but not cities in red states like Oklahoma City, Salt Lake City, Phoenix, that have similar policies, either officially or unofficially, but which wouldn't fit that picture of Eastern liberal elite permissiveness and coddling of criminals that the word sanctuary is supposed to evoke.
Well, Jeff, as always, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist at the University of California at Berkeley. His last book is titled Talking Right. If you're a politician seeking to demonize illegal immigrants, there's nothing to make you feel righteous quite like MS-13. The Salvadoran gang, also known as Mara Salvatrucha, has grown from its Los Angeles roots in the 70s to infiltrate and terrify a growing number of U.S. communities, where heavily tattooed gangbangers have engaged in crimes as petty as vandalism and as gruesome as machete dismemberments and murder. The largest part of the terror, however, has lived in the headlines as the press fixates on the Latin menace. One documentary on the National Geographic Channel called MS-13 the world's most dangerous gang. But gang population estimates suggest otherwise, and so does the testimony of many law enforcement officials. Kevin Prentice of the Justice Policy Institute has just co-authored a report titled Gang Wars, and he joins me now. Kevin, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me here.
Before we get started, you're not suggesting that a fast-growing gang with violent tendencies is of no concern, are you?
I think that any violent activity that's happening should be of concern, whether it's by gang members or other youth. And so obviously, when killings are happening, when stabbings are happening, that's a huge concern for the victims and families and communities that are involved.
But the idea of an MS-13 menace threatening all of us, even those of us, you know, hitherto feeling safe in the suburbs, is a bit overblown. Why?
In all of our work, we were unable to find any evidence that MS-13 was significantly different from any other street gang. In Los Angeles, MS-13 is just another gang. We asked whether, they said, yeah, they're a gang, they're a problem for us, just like 18th Street, plenty of other gangs, but they didn't see anything special in MS-13. It's really only out here in the East Coast, the Southeast, that people seem to be so terrified of MS-13.
You say that MS-13 is more of a brand than an organization. Are young men and boys attracted to it for the same reason they're attracted to, I don't know, Tommy Hilfiger?
Absolutely. And I think that law enforcement, politicians, and the media have really been the most effective at proliferating the MS-13 brand. And it's a combination, in fact, of our immigration policy, the deportation of many people from Los Angeles who were part of MS-13 to El Salvador that provided real fodder for gang growth, and then the TV coverage of the gang, the sort of hype that surrounds it, that's really made it the most exciting gang to be a part of. And I think that it's been publicized much too much. I talked to someone who'd gone to El Salvador and met a bunch of MS-13 members who'd basically recruited themselves from media coverage. They had never actually met a made MS-13 member before.
So what is it about MS-13 that has so captured the imagination of the press?
I think it's the fact that the suburbs are no longer lily white. There's a huge influx of immigrants into communities that had previously been all white or in the Southeast, white and black, and that's caused a great deal of fear. So activities that were probably going on among, say, white and black youth for many years in the Southeast are now attracting considerable attention because they're being done by strangers, outsiders who speak a strange language. And in fact, Latino and gang have become almost synonymous, although when I was growing up, it was Crips and Bloods, and you rarely heard about Latino gangs. Now, apparently, all gang members are Latino. There are other aspects, though, of MS-13 that I think captured the imagination. They have characteristics like the use of machetes, which, while I'd consider a machete a far less lethal weapon than a gun, the coverage has suggested that somehow machetes are an even more savage sort of weapon than any weapon previously conceived, and that machete-wielding gangsters should cause more fear than 15-year-olds with machine guns.
The fear of MS-13 has recently taken on some important political implications. As various politicians have come into Newark, New Jersey to decry the murders of three young students there by perpetrators allegedly including two illegal immigrants who may or may not have had gang connections and have not only connected them to MS-13, but to Muslim terrorists and God knows who all. Does MS-13 in fact stand for the political demonization of Latino immigrants in general?
Absolutely. And that's why the murder of, which was a gruesome murder of Brenda Paas near Washington, D.C. is so important, because it happened so close to the Capitol. I think that was either MS-13's greatest success or greatest mistake, depending on whether you want the gang to grow. They got the attention of federal lawmakers. That got the attention of the national media. And so MS-13 has become the poster child for the dangers of immigration, if you listen to the anti-immigrant advocates or people who need to be separated away from the good immigrants. And the reality of gangs, as we found out, is that there's all sorts of youth that get involved in gangs who have the possibility of going past it, right? That gang membership is not a lifelong thing. That's actually generally quite a transitory thing. But unfortunately, our obsession with MS-13 as the peril from south of the border coming wielding machetes and with their, you know, incredibly tight-knit political and criminal organization is really unfortunately distorting the debate.
Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Pranis of the Justice Policy Institute is co-author of the report titled Gang Wars. The internet, and especially online video, are the revolutionary technologies that have been storming the media bastille for a decade. There is already plenty of blood on the streets. The market value of mainstream media properties has been cut in half, for example. But the turning point of the struggle will almost certainly turn on video. YouTube and others have changed consumer behavior on a grand scale and ended Hollywood's monopoly on creating and distributing content. But nobody has figured out how to make money doing so, because nobody has figured out how to sell advertising against a 2-minute video clip. That is, maybe until now. Google has announced its long-awaited ad strategy for YouTube. It hinges on a scroll at the bottom of the video window. You can click on it, or you can ignore it altogether. My colleague Abby Clausen follows the technology beat for Advertising Age, and she joins me now. Abby, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob.
So is this the game changer everybody's been waiting and watching for?
Well, I think it's certainly something that we've all been anticipating since Google bought YouTube for $1.65 billion almost a year ago. What I think is interesting about this ad format and where YouTube is placing the ads is it's fairly confined to the premium and so-called torso or mid-tail content. It's not the true long-tail stuff that originally defined YouTube.
The stuff made by ordinary Joes for ordinary Joes.
Exactly. The toilet-flushing cats and the college kids lip-syncing in their dorm room to Backstreet Boys, that sort of thing.
Now, it seems to me that there's three things that online video has to do to succeed as an ongoing business. One is to find an ad format that consumers won't immediately reject. Let's start with that. That's been a problem till now. YouTube users just didn't want to watch a commercial before a video rolled and had no intention of sticking around after the video to watch one.
Absolutely. One of the things that Google has pushed pretty hard as they've introduced this ad unit is calling it less intrusive. They say that this unit, which is basically a simple flash-based graphic that appears across the lower 20% or so of the screen shortly after the video launches, they say that that's much less intrusive. It's what they call user-initiated, because when you see the unit, you can click it to play a video ad or a commercial or a 2-minute movie trailer. But if you don't click it, it goes away after about 5-10 seconds.
Okay, so maybe that's one problem solved, but the lingering problems are intellectual property. A lot of stuff on YouTube is basically stolen. And context. You know, if you're selling flea collars and you want to put your ad next to a cute little kitty cat, there's no way of knowing whether you're getting a cat flushing a toilet or a cat with a firecracker blowing up in its face.
I think that's one of the reasons that YouTube is rolling this out in a very limited fashion and only with the professional content with whom they've struck distribution agreements. People like Warner Music Group, Ford Models produces videos of, you know, style tips and that sort of thing. I mean, these are people that YouTube has gone out and signed to content deals. In that way, you know, they can ensure that they're not violating those copyrights. Why not roll it out widely? Because frankly, user-generated content is still very risky because of those copyright issues. And if YouTube started to monetize that stuff, it opens up a whole Pandora's box of issues for them, I'm afraid.
You mentioned that these ads are going to appear mainly on professionally produced content for the time being. Could this somehow divert the mission of YouTube from being basically a consumer-generated site to one that is just another distribution channel for the Hollywood big boys who we've grown accustomed to since time immemorial?
They said, in the end, we're not getting rid of user-generated content. We're definitely still going to stick to those roots. They said, and I'm quoting here one of their product managers who said, I wouldn't say the site is necessarily evolving in the sense of leading toward these monetization partners directly, but those users will get the opportunity by joining their partner program to be rewarded like any other content provider. Now, that's what they say. They say there will always be a home for user-generated content on YouTube. But if these aren't the videos they're monetizing, who knows? I mean, they're lucky enough that Google has deep pockets, that it can take a loss, serving some of the bandwidth for some of these really obscure user-generated videos that they'll never be able to monetize.
Okay, Abby, I really appreciate you joining us.
Thanks so much, Bob.
Abby Clausen covers technology for Advertising Age, which is where I have my day job. Coming up, how ambient technology communicates important information in a laid-back fashion. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. On the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Michael Deaver died this week. An aide to Ronald Reagan in his first term, Deaver is credited not only with enhancing the image of his boss, but of reinventing the way U.S. presidents engage with the media. Edmund Morris is the author of Dutch, a memoir of Ronald Reagan, and he joins us now to discuss Deaver's legacy. Edmund, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Ronald Reagan was famously the great communicator. How much of that communication is a debt owed to Michael Deaver?
About 3%.
I wasn't expecting that answer.
Ronald Reagan was a natural audio and video presence, and he'd been communicating in one form or another since 1933 when he first went into radio. So he knew how to time himself, he knew how to speak, he knew how to look, he knew how to move. But he did require a producer, and that's the function that Deaver brilliantly fulfilled.
I want to play a clip of Michael Deaver speaking to us a few years back.
We worked on a 60-90-day strategy so that I knew pretty well for the next 3 or 4 weeks what the news story was going to be 80% of the time. The people at CBS and NBC and NPR didn't know that.
And you knew which days you wanted to deflect attention from the true story of the day and which day you wanted to invite attention.
Of course.
Did he really co-opt the function of top editors and producers of TV?
Yes, I think he did. I was astonished during my years in the White House to see how abject the press was, how they would take anything given to them, particularly if it was well produced. I remember going to the Geneva summit and seeing how the press just sat in an enormous room waiting to be given leads on what the night's story would be. So Mike sensed this laziness on the part of the press and gave them prepackaged stories. His message got through and the president looked terrific and the media cooperated.
What was his secret?
I think he just had an instinct for what was important and what was simple. He understood, for example, that a country brought up on television and on the screen is more impressed by the way things look than the way things sound. I'm sure you're aware of the famous story of Reagan making a terrible political gaffe one day and being picked on by CBS News. But Deaver, when he was called by CBS News to alert him to the fact that this gaffe was going to be broadcast that night, watched it and said afterwards that he was delighted because the president looked so good.
He was big on backgrounds, the physical backdrop behind whatever the president was actually saying with his lips.
Yes, that was the producer in him. He understood, for example, that Reagan would look terrific mounted on a promontory looking out over the English Channel when he went to celebrate the 40th anniversary of D-Day. He understood that Reagan needed to be seen in full body, if possible, because his body was impressive. And he understood the most classic example of his production values was the funeral, which he choreographed, climaxing with that sunset farewell on the Pacific coast, the sun sinking into the sea at precisely the moment the diva wanted it to sink.
And it was an extraordinary achievement, if for no other reason than the fact that Reagan, who was a controversial president, to say the least, saw his passing noted with almost no resurrection of the scandals of his presidency.
Yes, I think we can probably ascribe a lot of that to Diva, in the sense that the sentimental legend which grew up after Reagan's departure became almost overwhelming. And we forget now that the presidency did have its dark moments, particularly the Bitburg episode of 1985, which is almost forgotten now, but which I've always felt was an extremely poignant moral drama.
This was the president visiting a cemetery in Germany where members of the SS were buried, which triggered an enormous controversy.
Through Diva's rather sloppy advance work, it was not noticed that the graves, as you say, in this particular military cemetery, were polluted by the presence of SS. Diva took the fall for that. But Reagan very characteristically insisted on going through with this wildly controversial appearance.
The history of the 20th century is a history of presidential advisors with power perhaps disproportionate to their actual job titles. You know, I'm thinking of H.R. Haldeman with Nixon, and then Karl Rove with George Bush, Robert Kennedy with John F. Kennedy. How about Deaver? Was he a power broker, or was he just an image maker?
Oh, he was the most powerful man in the White House during the first term. James Baker was nominally the chief of staff, but because Deaver had this intimate, almost son-like filial relationship with Nancy, he was the one who had the closest access to the Reagans. Through his work with her, he controlled the president's schedule and also controlled the sort of people that the president got to see.
Michael Deaver was the father of the presidential photo op, and I guess his legacy is the triumph in presidential politics of image over substance. Do you think that's a legacy of which he would have been proud?
Yes, and rightly so, too. But we must remember that there was substance there. Reagan was not an image. He was an extremely substantial and important president, and he happened to be dramatically gifted, and that's why Diva was so good at choreographing his theatrical appearances. Future presidential aides tried to treat their presidents the same way as Diva did Ronald Reagan. They're going to have to be sure that the president is capable of performing in the way the producer needs.
Edmund Morris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Presidential historian Edmund Morris is the author of Dutch, a memoir of Ronald Reagan. His short biography of Beethoven, titled Beethoven, the Universal Composer, was released last year. Last week, the Chicago Sun-Times editorial page did something seldom seen, at least in the past 50 years. It registered a scathing opinion, not just with a carefully worded argument, but with calls for a reader boycott of a corporation. The company is British Petroleum, and the boycott is in response to a recent permit granted to a BP oil refinery on the Indiana side of Lake Michigan that will allow for increased industrial waste discharges into the lake. The editorial page of the Sun-Times has historically leaned conservative, but with new management and a new editorial page editor has come a new populist political stance. Cheryl Reed is that editorial page editor, and she joins us now. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob. Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Wow. Call for a boycott. That's a pretty bold move. Do you know, by any chance, when the last time the Sun-Times incited the public in this way?
Well, certainly not in this way, but I'm sure that we have incited them in many other ways. No one here seems to recall the last time that we called for a boycott of a corporation.
Now, far be it from me to be an apologist for BP, but there's no accusation that they did anything illegal or untoward here. Why call for this particular kind of action?
Well, our legislators in Illinois and the newspaper and our residents in Chicago were very concerned when we learned that this was basically a done deal. And at that point, we were learning that BP was being allowed to dump 54% more ammonia and 35% more tiny sludge. Now, when you can actually see the intake boat out in Lake Michigan taking in your drinking water, you understand why people in Chicago are very upset that a company that made $22.3 billion last year can't seem to find a quarter of an acre in order to put a plant that would process the ammonia so they wouldn't have to dump that into our lake.
Yeah, just to clarify, BP is situated on a 1,700-acre parcel in northern Indiana where the refinery is. Still in all, you know, one of the papers in Chicago, actually I think it was your competitor, the Tribune, did point out that while there would be a substantial increase in the dumping of ammonia, it's quite the drop in the bucket compared to just what rainfall delivers into Lake Michigan because of air pollution.
Well, we can't really control what is being dropped into the lake because of air. What we can control is a company who is on the banks of Lake Michigan and is making a decision to dump more pollution purposefully into the lake.
But once again, if BP behaved legally, shouldn't the target here be the government of Indiana and the governor, Mitch Daniels, who supported this licensing on the grounds of 80 new permanent jobs and 2,000 temporary jobs during the expansion of the refinery? If there are culprits here, isn't it them?
There are culprits here, and Chicago sent a contingent down to Indianapolis today to testify at a hearing in front of the Indiana EPA, and they were denied the ability to testify. So, I mean, obviously, Indiana and the governor of Indiana doesn't want to listen to people from Illinois complaining that we think BP, the green company that is trying to tout its image as, you know, environmentally friendly, that this company should spend a little more money and try to process their pollution.
In these past 7 weeks, as you've tried to help lift this newspaper from the ashes of the Conrad Black scandal, is BP a victim of you just, you know, looking around for a hot issue that you can use to announce yourself?
No, I think that we're very passionate and we've been given license to be passionate. And that's what our new editorial direction is about. It's about trying to engage readers and tap into what our readers are thinking. And that's why we were outraged when we read the stories. I don't think that's trying to appeal to subscribers or try to win over people in the wake of Conrad Black. I really don't.
Companies behave abominably all the time because, after all, the free market is free of many things, including conscience, and some far more abominably than this. Will you be calling for, do you suppose, for further boycotts when companies, let's say those outside of Chicago, get caught doing something egregious?
Yes, I think when it's warranted, when we have evidence that these companies we find are dumping into the lake or doing something that we consider egregious, yes, we will take them on.
Well, Cheryl, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Cheryl Reed is the editorial page editor of the Chicago Sun-Times. Environmental responsibility is an issue on everybody's radar these days, and this month in Wired magazine, Clive Thompson describes a new way for energy consumers to be aware of their consumption. It is an orb. It is awesome. Clive, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Now, this is about ambient technology. Tell me what that means.
Well, ambient technology is a way of delivering information in a more calming way. The idea arose about 10 years ago in response to the fact that computers, particularly computers, were becoming much more stressful because they had so many sources of information that they're forcing you to stare at. There's email and there's browsers and now there's YouTube and all this stuff. And so people were getting sort of drowned in all the information that they had to stare at. And the idea was, well, maybe we should try and take some information and just sort of put it in the periphery of your eye span, as it were, you know, so that it's something you sort of glance at every once in a while. You don't have to stare at it.
Like a wall clock or a thermometer?
Precisely. A wall clock is a classic piece of ambient information because even though you're not really aware of ever looking at it, you always generally know what time it is. And so it's a non-stressful source of information. And it turns out that when they do studies, they find that ambient information, people actually retain it, sometimes even better than they do the stuff that they're staring at.
Now comes the orb, which is a new medium. Tell me about the history of the orb, and then we can talk about this current application.
Well, the orb is the invention of a guy named David Rose. He's got a company called Ambient Devices. And his idea was, okay, let's try taking important information off the computer screen and into the periphery of your attention. And he wanted a little beautiful thing that would be sort of pleasant to have sitting in the corner of your desk. And so he thought of a glowing orb. And his first application, and everyone loved this, was that you would set it to monitor your stock portfolio so that it would glow green or whatever if you know, you could pick the color. It would glow green if things were going well, and it would slowly darken to purple or whatever if your stock portfolio was going down. And so the idea being that you would sort of generally know whether or not your financial health is being taken care of without having to go to E-Trade, you know, five times a day or whatever and look at your portfolio. And it really worked. It turned out when they did studies, they found that people were about like, I'm sketchy on the exact amount, but it's around like 30 or 40% more likely to do active trading, you know, once every month or so if they had an orb because they could see, wait a minute, something's wrong with my portfolio.
It's a way to synthesize a lot of information just with a color spectrum.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did the orb come to be embraced for energy consumption?
What happened was that an engineer at a Californian energy firm decided to see if he could hack people's perceptions to make them a little more aware of their energy usage by using orbs. And what he did was he basically bought about 1,000 of these orbs and put them in people's houses and configured them so that they would glow different colors based on whether or not the grid was being really stressed, if it was really being overused at total capacity, you know, it would glow red or whatever. And if the grid was actually not being used, it would glow green or whatever. The idea being that people would sort of have a sense of what the energy environment around them was like, and they would react accordingly. They would turn things off when energy was getting overstressed and too expensive, and they would save themselves money. And they would save, you know, their energy usage for when it was, you know, glowing green and things were less stressed. And sure enough, the same thing happened. People actually very effortlessly started changing their energy usage habits, and they conserved a lot more energy because they had suddenly they had information about what was going on around them.
Now, in your piece in Wired, yeah, you actually wrote about a second stage of awareness, and that is when your awareness isn't a closely held secret, but your own energy consumption is made available to a larger audience. Tell me how that works.
It's called the Sentinel Effect. If you let other people know what you're doing, their scrutiny will sort of freak you out, and you'll try and do better, as it were. So if everyone were able to imagine like a world where like I've got my little energy orb or whatever, but it broadcasts, you know, through my blog or my website to all my friends, Clive's energy usage of the last week was, you know, up 20% or down 10%. You can sort of imagine this very quickly take on like almost like a social virus type effect where people would be almost actively reducing even more of their energy usage so they won't look like a complete energy glutton in front of their friends, you know? It would have a really wonderful social effect. There's already a little experiment like this happening. Over in Britain, there's this cool company that have created this thing called the Watson, and it's sort of like a little glowing brick. It does the same thing as the orb. It glows different colors based on your energy usage. But the really cool thing is it's networked to the internet. So it feeds that information online if you want it to, and you can go online and you can compare yourself with other Watson users and see who's reduced the most energy. And the other cool thing is you can see sort of how much in total all the Watson users have saved. That to me is really interesting because one of the problems with personal conservation is that it feels like it's just a drop in the bucket. Like, why am I bothering to turn off this light? It's not going to do anything. Whereas if you could go online and see that a million people had all turned off a light and you just saved 100 megawatts or the equivalent of 24 hours functioning of one coal-fired plant, that would really start to feel much more exciting and you'd be more likely to turn off that light.
Way cool. Clive, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Clive Thompson writes about technology. His piece about the orb appears in the August issue of Wired magazine. That's it for this week's show. On the Media, it was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, who is getting married this weekend, and edited this week by me. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Andrea Ambrose and Madeline Elish. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl. Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke will be back in 2 weeks. I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.